This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com. This sentence is false. True or false? Paradoxes have fascinated and infuriated philosophers since Zeno, 2.5 millennia ago. He attempted to show that time and motion were impossible, and that, for example, speedy Achilles could never overtake a tortoise. These brain teasers are fun for some people and give headaches to others, but do they tell us anything useful or substantial about the world? Or at least about philosophy? Questions for paradox enthusiast Peter Cave.
Peter Cave, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Well, Nigel, I'm very, very pleased to be here. I'm just wondering how strong your bite is.
The topic we're going to focus on today, I hope, is paradoxes. The obvious place to start with this is, what is a paradox?
Well, with the word paradox, if you go back to its etymology, it just means beyond belief. And so paradoxes really are concerned with things in the common sense way, which are very surprising. An example of that is, I think, in the early 17th century, the fact that the Earth goes round the sun was taken to be paradoxical. That's rather different, though, from the philosophical concern with paradoxes, because as a philosopher, one likes to find something deeper, some sort of contradiction or inconsistency, which it seems incredibly difficult to rule out, such that you really find something paradoxical, because there seems to be no easy way of getting out of it.
So a paradox is really the situation when you start with a belief you think is obviously true, and then somehow you come across something that absolutely contradicts that belief, and yet both the belief and the contradiction seem to be obviously true.
That's very much so, and as a philosopher, one tends to be reasoning from these seemingly obviously true statements, yet then you end up with something which contradicts that beginning position.
So could you give an example, just to illustrate this, a classic paradox?
One which many, many people may have heard of is Achilles and the tortoise. Achilles was meant to be the fastest runner in Athens, you know. This is in ancient Greek times. And the tortoise was the typical, rather slow-running tortoise. Still, they decide to have a race. In fact, an ancient Greek philosopher called Zeno sets up the race. Achilles is rather generous, so he gives a nice long start for the tortoise. Then, dear Zeno, he starts doing a little bit of reasoning about how the race is going to go, because for Achilles to win the race, he's got to overtake the tortoise. And for him to overtake the tortoise, he's got to get to where the tortoise starts. So off goes Achilles to get to the starting place of the tortoise, by which time, of course, the tortoise, however slowly he moves, will have moved a little bit further on. And so in order to win the race, Achilles has now got to get to the new position of the tortoise. But however slowly the tortoise moves, by the time Achilles gets to that second place, where the tortoise is, the tortoise will have moved on a little bit further. So Zeno says, Achilles has got to complete an endless series of runs, because however small those runs are, they will just carry on endlessly, like a half, a quarter, an eighth, a sixteenth, and so on and so on. So dear Zeno, being, dare I say, somewhat conceited, thinks, hey, this shows the world is wrong in some way. Motion is impossible. You can't overtake things. You can't move at all.
But obviously, Achilles would overtake the tortoise in real life.
Hence, we have the classic philosophical contradiction.
Now, in that case, it seems to me, I'm going to put my money on Achilles winning the race. If something's wrong, it's got to be this notion that before you get to one point, you've got to move half the distance, and that's going to take time, and then the further half, and so on. That's the one which looks to be wrong there.
Yes, this is indeed a paradox in which we at least seem to be happy, contrary to what Zeno says, to say it's pretty clear motion does take place, and so we've got to explain what goes wrong with the reasoning. Many mathematicians are inclined to say, we've solved all this now, because infinite series, such as a half, and a quarter, and an eighth, and so on, they do actually converge to a number. But some philosophers, and I am one of them, would insist on saying, but nonetheless, there's a problem in our representation of what's going on, because there's an endless sequence of events to be conducted. So how could you ever end them?
So could you give another example of a paradox?
Well, let me give another example of a paradox which perhaps is the same type, in that it's trying to bring out that the way in which we understand the world, the way in which philosophers conceptualize the world, can actually raise these big, deep contradictions. True, people tend to think that infinity is all a bit abstract in any case, but we don't seem to think there's any great problem in the concept of murder or killing someone. In courts of law, people are found to be guilty of murder and they get sent to jail. So this is a very, very practical issue, and yet nonetheless, here's a typical philosophical paradox concerning it. I give the example in terms of Bandit. Bandit is out in the desert and Bandit shoots, intending to kill the sheriff. The sheriff is indeed mortally wounded. The sheriff is rushed back to the Little Rock dock and he's lying there dying. Bandit rushes back to his mountain hideaway. Before Sheriff dies, though, what really happens is that a lynch mob sets off and they manage to find Bandit and they lynch Bandit. So Bandit dies before the sheriff dies. And the sheriff, though, does duly die. Here, then, we have a question. When did the killing take place? Did it take place when Bandit shot the sheriff in the desert? Well, no, the sheriff wasn't dead at that point. He carries on living for a few more days. Did the killing take place, then, when Sheriff actually died a few days later? Well, that seems counterintuitive, because Bandit is already dead, so how could a dead man do the killing or the murdering?
Yeah, so Bandit presumably can't be a murderer, because when he died, the sheriff was still alive. So he wasn't a murderer at the point when he died.
So it would seem, and equally so, where did he actually commit the murder? Did it take place in the desert? Well, no, the sheriff was still alive in the desert. Did it take place in the Little Rock town? Well, no, Bandit didn't ever meet the Little Rock town. He never went there. So there's a big question there of jurisdiction, and it's a very important question, because, of course, whether somebody does get had up for murder depends on the laws of the state. What punishment they get might depend on their age and so on, depending on the state. So here is another big problem, Nigel, I think, in which one's trying to understand how our representation of the world through our concepts such as killing or murder or indeed running or infinity relate to the real world around us.
I'm still not convinced by the paradox of murder as you've set it up, because I think a murder is committed when somebody intentionally kills somebody and succeeds in killing them. Where the person dies isn't part of our concept of the murder.
Well, we know where he was intending to kill, but you then slipped into saying, and also where he killed that person. But the question is, where did he kill the person?
Let's accept that is a paradox, but many things which we call paradoxes aren't genuinely paradoxes, because there is a way out that one of the premises proves to be unfounded, perhaps.
Yes, that's true, and although some paradoxes in philosophy have gone on for many centuries, in some cases, many philosophers will think, well, we've at least have solved the problem there. A famous paradox which was discussed by Bertrand Russell is the barber paradox. You have a very simple idea that a barber could, in fact, decide to shave all those people who do not shave themselves. And in this particular case, then, we have a barber in Alcala, and the barber, it is said, then shaves all and only those people who do not shave themselves. The question then is, well, where's the truth of the situation with regard to the barber? Does he shave himself or not? If he does shave himself, then he should be somebody whom he doesn't shave. And if he doesn't shave himself, then he should be somebody whom he does shave. So here we seem to have a problem in which the barber is both truthfully shaving himself and truthfully not shaving himself, which is a blatant contradiction, and most of us tend to think the world cannot be a contradictory place in that way. Hence, as you said, Nigel, that may be the case in which we can now say, but that isn't really a paradox, because we postulated the existence of a barber who does these things, and yet maybe we should just conclude there can be no such barber.
That sounds a bit like the liar paradox.
Yes, and it is a paradox to do with self-reference, as it's called, because the liar paradox is the liar who says, in this very statement itself, I am lying. So then, if what he's saying is true, then what he's saying should be false. And if what he's saying is false, then what he's saying should be true. There's a very quick way with that particular version of it, which philosophers tend to agree on, namely, why not just say that what he's expressing is neither true nor false? Of course, the cunning philosopher will say, in this very statement, I'm saying something that is neither true nor false. Now, is that true or false or neither true nor false? As you run through those options, you'll get similar contradictions. So the liar paradox, in its what's called the strengthened version, is a version which still baffles many, many philosophers.
And there's another category of paradoxes that I find quite interesting, about the limits of reason.
Yes, that's certainly true, because if we go back to the liar just for the moment, that really is raising a question about how sentences or statements can be true or false, or whether they could be neither true nor false. They're raising questions about truth. And a related question to truth, as you say, is indeed a question to do with reason and rationality. A wonderful example of that is one which I've called the poison chalice. Lady Bountiful offers you £1,000,000. At first, maybe the offer is that you should actually drink from a poison chalice, some horrible, horrible wine, unlike the wine you've just given me, Nigel. It's wine which will really make you feel dreadfully ill for a few days, but nonetheless it has no lasting side effects. You'll be perfectly well after a few days. Obviously you wouldn't like to have such a horrible drink, but nonetheless £1 million is very, very tempting. That's straightforward, though. You may just go ahead and drink it and get £1 million. But here's a more cunning Lady Bountiful. Lady Bountiful in this case says, no, the issue is not that you drink the wine, that's up to you. But the issue is that to get £1 million, you just need to intend to drink of this poison chalice, this poison wine. Let's specify it slightly more determinately. So Lady Bountiful says to you at midnight, please formulate the intention to drink this nasty drink the next day. And if you do formulate that intention, then indeed, in a few hours' time, I will really give you £1 million. Philosophers that we are, of course, we may now start thinking about this. I can see you're already thinking about this, Nigel, because you think, hold on, I only have to form the intention. I don't actually have to do the drinking of this horrible stuff. It'll be utterly irrational to drink it. So therefore, I'll just form the intention at midnight. But now, of course, being a philosopher, you have to think that won't be a sincere intention, will it? So your reflective philosophical reasoning has actually left us in a mess, because it seems we can't win £1 million.
We can't win £1 million, but it does actually show us something philosophical here, that our concept of intention has within it the idea that to have a genuine intention, you have to also intend to fulfil that intention, or it wouldn't conceptually be an intention.
Yes, that indeed is true. And we could add that somebody who is not very reflective, who is not a philosopher, would actually get £1 million in this case, because they may just think, hey, we really will intend to go ahead and drink the stuff, and they go ahead and drink it, suffer the pain for 2 days, but they will have got £1 million. But with philosophers who are inclined to reflect about these things, the very reflection itself can generate the problem, because they can reason that it would be utterly irrational to drink of that poison chalice after their intention has been formed, and that in itself undermines intention. Then the problem here is that rationally you need to be irrational. I don't know if you want to hear about the surprise examination paradox, but that has a similar structure.
Go on, surprise me.
No, it won't be a surprise. But the surprise examination is some school children are told, and this really happens, you're going to have a surprise examination next week. It'll be either Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday or Friday at noon. And of course, a bright kid might start thinking, well, hold on, if it really is going to be a surprise examination, then it can't occur on the Friday, because if I get through to Friday unsurprised by the examination, it would have to be on Friday, so Friday's ruled out. Now the philosophical child thinks a little more and says, well, hold on, I know Friday's ruled out, so if I get through to Thursday morning, it would have to be Thursday, so therefore it couldn't be a surprise, so therefore Thursday is ruled out. And he reasons all the way back down, ruling out Wednesday and Tuesday and Monday, and so he sits here at the weekend thinking there cannot be a surprise examination. And of course, one day the teacher will intrude upon his complacency and surprise him with an examination. What's gone wrong? Well, I assure all your listeners that there are many, many articles written on this about exactly where the mistake is.
So you're saying these kinds of paradoxes are ones in which our reason can actually undermine the process of thought and bring in a contradiction that wouldn't otherwise be apparent?
Yes, again, looking at the surprise examination, if you have a non-reflective pupil, you don't actually have a problem with it. The problem only arises once you start reflecting on it.
Now, are these just like crossword puzzles? They're fun to try and think about and solve if we can. Or is there some deeper philosophical content that's expressed through our examination of these?
Of course, I'm bound to say I think they're far more interesting and far deeper than crossword puzzles or Sudoku. In these particular cases, there tends to be a thought that reason should be able to work things out. But as we've just seen, there seems to be times when it's reasonable or rational to be irrational. In the case of the liar paradox, we tend to think we have a firm grip on the idea of which statements are true and which are false. And yet, as the liar paradox shows us, we really have to start thinking about how our truths and falsities relate to the world and to each other. And going right back to Achilles and the tortoise, yes, obviously we do know we move, obviously we do know we can touch the wall and we can overtake tortoises, but nonetheless there's a genuine problem here about how concepts such as infinity or murder or indeed other concepts can be applied to the world.
Peter, you're obviously a connoisseur of paradoxes. What's your favourite one?
I must admit there is one which I am particularly fond of. It's about a donkey, but it's often called an ass. In fact, it's Buridan's ass or Buridan's donkey. It was put forward by Jean Buridan in about the 12th or 13th century Paris. Maybe he didn't actually put it forward, but his disciples did. Here we have an ass who is stuck between two bundles of hay. They're exactly the same size, they're the same distance from him, one's to the left and one's to the right. They have the same degree of succulence, the same degree of density, and so on. Now, our ass is a rational ass, he's a rational donkey, and so he thinks, as many philosophers do think, that we must always have a reason for what we do, or a reason for what we prefer over something else. And so he looks on the bundle of hay on the left and the bundle of hay on the right, thinking, well, I should eat the one on the left, but then he notices the one on the right, that's equally succulent, so how can he choose? Being unable to find a sufficient reason to choose either of these, he in fact starves to death. Some people see it as being a problem of one bundle of hay too many, or I call it a bale of woe too many. But even if you just had one bale of straw in front of the ass, he still has to choose, should I go for the top bit first or the lower bit first? And so it's a very deep problem, I think, about how reasons motivate actions.
So in a way, it's about the limitations of our concept of rationality.
It certainly is making us think about to what extent should we be rational, should we be looking for reasons. Picking up on the way in which you put it, you might say that in order to be rational, it doesn't actually mean you need to have a reason for every facet of what you do. But of course, then the problem becomes, well, which facet should you have reasons for and which facet should you not have reasons for? And so, as with most of these things, philosophers can go on staying in business almost endlessly.
At that point, I think we should wrap up. So, Peter Cave, thank you very much.
Are you trying to tell me, Nigel, that we have just managed to end something which I said was endless? We're back in Zeno's paradox territory, but it's been great to be with you.
And you can hear more Philosophy Bites at www.philosophybites.com.